Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, Mets fans. This is Rich Farrago, known as CT Mets Fan on Twitter, and you are listening to the Metsian Podcast with Sam, Rich, and Mike. And tonight it's with Rich and Mike and a special guest, and I'll get to that in just a moment. But as is typically the case with the New York Mets, there's a lot to talk about. And as is typically the case, baseball season is almost exactly a month old, the case for this year. There's been a lot of good stuff to talk about, and we'll get into that. We'll get into the upcoming series with the Phillies that I think should be very exciting, you know, four games down in Philadelphia. We'll talk about the Mets start to date and some of the exciting things that have happened in this past week. And to do that, let me bring in one of my podcasting colleagues. We will have he and I this evening. We won't have all three of us, and we'll bring on our special guest in just a moment. So let me go down to Brooklyn, a borough that I rode through as part of the five borough tour on Sunday. I don't believe I went through your neighborhood, Mike, but let me bring on Mr. Mike LeCullen. So, Mike, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. I'm a happy camper. Hello, Metsville. Hello, Rich. And, you know, let's go Mets. Good times. Like you said, we're a month into this, and things are looking good.
That they are. And so Mike and I have some help to unpack all this Mets news tonight. I'd like to welcome on John Springer. Let me say a couple of words about John. So John is a Queens-based journalist and creator of Mets by the Numbers Project, a history of the Mets by uniform number that has resided on the web since 1999 and published as a book by Skyhorse Publishing in 2008 and 2016, assembling the first and most comprehensive examination of the Mets uniform and jersey numbers. Mets by the Numbers may be the longest-running fan-created Mets website still in existence. I think that's pretty damn cool, and I think it's equally cool to have John Springer joining us. He's joined us before. So, John, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, guys. Really thrilled to be here.
Excellent, excellent. And so what we'll do is, you know, let's talk about the Mets news, and then I do want to talk about some Mets numbers and some, you know, maybe some of the unique stuff. At some point tonight, you know, things like Turk Wendell wearing zero and things like that, and Tony Clark wearing 99. And, you know, maybe we can have a little fun with that. I think Mike and I go well back into the early 70s as Mets fans. So we might have a little fun with some Mets numbers. So gentlemen, let's jump right in and let's start here. I'd like to really start with last Friday night, where the Mets did something that has only been done 17 times in Major League Baseball history, and that is they threw a combined no-hitter. Five Mets combined on the effort. I have seen comments on this all over the board. Let's start with Jerry Blevins in the Mets doing the booth work, you know, for SNY. He was like, okay, you know, it's a nice thing, but, you know, it's not the same because it's not one guy who did the whole thing. I've seen other people say it's actually more special because it's only been done 17 times. I believe the number is 331, give or take one or two, for no hitters in baseball history. And when only 17 of them have been combined, it certainly is very special. So that's what I want to ask you guys. I want to ask you guys, this combined no hitter, how special was it to you? Was it maybe more special than the Johan one? Less so? I'd like to get your thoughts. So, Mike, let's start with you. What do you think about the combined no-hitter?
It's cool. You know, I'm old school. A no-hitter to me is a starting pitcher going nine innings and getting it done. But this is fun. This is cool. I won't swallow everything and steal everyone's thunder. We'll get into Tyler Megill. But the reason why I found it so enjoyable, yeah, it was a team effort. But it's the way they finished. You know, after Drew Smith struck out JT Realmuto to start the seventh, Jolie Rodriguez, he walked Kyle Schwarber. And then the Mets converted a 6-4-3 double play. That was huge. And then they closed out the game. Diaz looked awesome, striking out the side. And that's how you finish. And that's why I enjoyed it so much, that, and because it came against the Phillies.
Well, there you have it. So, John, before going to you on it, I'll throw in my personal opinion, because I was rather opinionated about it. I thought it was great. To me, it was more important than the Yoan no-hitter, because I can't get it out of my mind that the Yoan no-hitter was not a no-hitter. You know, Beltran's ball was fair. We all know it. Sure, it's in the books as a no-hitter, and it broke the schneid, you know, of the Mets not having a no-hitter from 1962 to 2012. Okay, it's officially a no-hitter in the books. That's great. But in my mind, I always knew it was not a legitimate no-hitter. This was a legitimate no-hitter, complete with great play to save it. You know, Brandon Nimmo, although it was earlier in the game, great diving catch. To me, like I said earlier, the fact that it's combined, in my opinion, makes it more special because it's more rare. But, John, where do you stand with it?
I'm more with you, Rich. You know, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And for some of the reasons you said, I would agree that it was almost more special than the Santana thing. You know, that has part to do with my own perspective. I kind of like the quirky history, I think you'll find from reading my work. And I almost like the fact no-hitters are so random that it was almost special that the Mets had managed to have such a great pitching history and never have a no-hitter. It was almost a badge of kind of a weird badge of honor. And to see, you know, I can remember watching that Santana game, you know, halfway through and thinking that, you know, this specter of the fact that the team had never had a no-hitter was going to drive every decision that was made in that game and, you know, overemphasize the Beltran hit, which, you know, in a replay world would have definitely been a double. And, you know, what was it, 157 pitches or something like that? And Santana winds up damaged beyond belief. I'm not going to, you know, point the finger to that one game. Pitching's a dangerous game. But, you know, it felt like the Mets were kind of going after a no-hitter in the Santana game, whereas this game against the Phillies, it was five guys all doing what you'd asked of them to do, and there was no controversy. I loved it. And, you know, you mentioned the Nimmo catch. Really, I think the best play of the game might have been Escobar's fielding of the very first hit of the game where he, you know, it wasn't a spectacular play, but one of those plays where, you know, if you don't have a professional doing everything absolutely right, that easily goes as an infield single. And, you know, we don't even think about no hitter. I enjoyed the heck out of it. You know, I didn't believe it was going to happen. I was terrified that, you know, Diaz was going to blow it and then delighted to see it was probably his finest moment as a Met. So I loved it.
I agree. I was actually pacing my living room floor in the ninth inning. And with Diaz, I don't know how you feel about this, guys. You can just jump in on it. Having watched this guy since 2019, in my opinion, the first one or two pitches he throws in an outing, you can tell right away what you're going to get. If he misses the strike zone by a lot, you know you're in for trouble. But if he's 99 over the plate or he snaps off one of those sliders and it catches the outside corner, you know you're in for a good outing. And he just looked on. He looked on from the moment he took that mound. So any comments on that, on Diaz? Anybody want to agree or disagree with that?
I agree with you.
He just embarrassed those guys, 2, 3, and 4 in the lineup, versus 3, 4, and 5 in the lineup. Just absolutely crushed them. It was a beautiful thing to see, and this was the Diaz that Brody, you know, thought he was trading for when he took on all of Robbie Cano and all his contract, you know, just for that opportunity. So I loved it.
And he's
definitely
maturing,
Mike. Go ahead.
You know, he's still a young guy. He's maturing. He probably understands his craft a little better. You know, we still have a whole season ahead of us. But, you know, Diaz, he tries to get batters to swing outside the zone. And hitters try to bring him back into the zone. It's a cat and mouse, and he got the better of them that game.
He sure did. And it's when Diaz is on, it's a pleasure to watch. And when he's not on, it's not even like, I don't know. My observation is there's no middle ground with him. He's either very good, which he's been more of lately, or he's pretty bad. And thank God he was on his game that night, because I was sweating bullets, you know, because to me, like I said, in my own, my head, it's really the first legitimate no-hitter in franchise history. So I loved it. And so let's talk about that game a little bit. The starting pitcher was Tylor Megill. And Megill, you know, you mentioned him earlier, Mike. What a find he's been. Now, going into today's game, not counting today's game, he was 4-0 with a 1.93 ERA. And in 28 innings pitched, he had allowed 18 hits and struck out 27. He's throwing in the mid to upper 90s. You know, last year, sure. You know, when he first came up, we saw some very good starts. But then he clearly ran out of gas at the end of the season. And when you saw him being the starting pitcher on opening night in Washington, you're kind of like, at least I was, kind of like, oh, man, like, what's this about? But this guy has totally stepped up. Now, if you watch the game today, he was really very good. Yes, he gets the loss today. It was more on the bullpen. I think we all know that. He left the game with the bases loaded and went out, and those runs scored, so those runs were charged his account, and he got the loss. But he also pitched effectively today. He pitched into the sixth inning, you know, with five shutout innings, five and third, until he loaded the bases and left and ended up, like I said, getting tagged with those runs. But he was able to wiggle his way out of trouble, get big strikeouts when he needed them, and that's kind of been what we've seen from Megill right from the beginning of the season. So, John, I'll start with you on this. We saw the good Tylor. We saw the tiring, not so good Tylor last year. Are you surprised by what he's doing?
Yes. I mean, he's been a pleasant surprise. Let's put it that way. I think if you looked at his year last year, you saw a guy that had some ability. And then if you kind of like looked and tried to make a case for him in your mind, you'd say, you know, at least I said to myself, you know, this guy is a big, strong dude, right? He's bigger than Syndergaard, right? I mean, he's actually taller, I think, and wider than Syndergaard, right? So you figure he's got the physical tools to do it. So it's not, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that he could add a couple miles per hour on his fastball and become that much more effective, which is what happens. And then, you know, the other thing that strikes me about him is how sort of laconic and unperturbable he appears. You know, he's kind of like, you know, calmly chewing gum on the mound. He's rather expressionless and businesslike. And, you know, I know that came up, you know, for example, when they said, well, you know, we're giving you the opening day start because, you know, of the injury issues we've had. And you thought, well, you know, he might not blow away the team, but, you know, he might not be freaked out by it. And I think both of those things came true. He's added something physical to his game, and his demeanor has served him really well in kind of getting through these, you know, difficult situations that he puts himself in. And, you know, so far so good, right, on that. You know, would I expect him to carry, what you say his ERA was 1.93, you know, through the end of the year? No. You know, he's more than adequate in sort of making up this deficit we've gotten in starting pitching. And a major reason, geez, we're off to such a wonderful start.
Pitching is a huge reason why the Mets are 18-9, you know, ahead by, I believe it's 3.5 games in the National League East at this point. Although, you know, standings at this point are kind of silly, but certainly the Mets are enjoying a very nice start. So, Mike, I'll go to you on Tylor Megill. I know you mentioned his name earlier. What have been your observations other than the fact that his mom is very active on Twitter?
Well, I'm going to agree with John insofar as that I'm somewhat surprised as well. Rich, it's the ones you never see coming, you know. DeGrom snuck up on us as well. You know, we had other people ahead of him on the hierarchy. So, you know, it's a pleasant surprise, and for the reasons that you mentioned, Rich. He entered today's game with a whip under one, and he's been very good. He's been very impressive. And, you know, with today's outing, through the first four innings, he didn't give up a hit. So that gives him a block of nine consecutive innings of no-hit baseball, even though the record books will never reflect that. But it's nice to have a little bit, huh?
Oh, for sure. While we're on McGill, let's talk about this. So he tossed 5 1/3 today, so he's at 33 1/3 for the season. And we are about, not even 20% of the way through yet. So where I'm going with this, you can probably see it coming, is workload, right? Here's a guy who I believe the most professional innings he'd ever thrown is around 140-ish. And he's going to blow past that. You know, if we're not even 20% through the season and he's already over 30 innings, Buck talks a lot about, and I think this is something that maybe gets by me once in a while. I think it gets by a lot of people. You know, they talk about how Buck is a couple of steps ahead. He's always thinking 3 and 4 steps ahead, whereas it seems like a lot of managers might think 1 or 2 steps ahead. So some of the stuff Buck does, he's got a reason for it, and usually it's more forward-looking. So about McGill, you know, he was saying that with an off day coming up on Monday, they could give him the extra day. He's talked a lot about managing McGill's innings because if he's going to be this good, you don't want to shut this guy down in August. You don't want to shut him down in September either. You want to have him in the postseason. But how do you manage that? Like, how do you manage the fact that with a natural progression, what's realistic for him? 170 this year? He's still, you know, at the rate he's going to go way past that. And we haven't even talked about postseason. So, John, I'll go to you on that. Do you think it's important to manage his innings like Buck is doing, or like you said earlier, big, strong guy, let's not be so concerned?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to say. I wouldn't know necessarily, you know, how to best manage a big league pitcher like that. But, you know, I agree with you that Buck is thinking ahead, and I have a general trust in him. I think the saying is, you know, good managers are thinking, you know, ahead of the game, and other guys are thinking about what they already screwed up, or, you know, what already happened. And I think Buck is in that first category and would give this and other issues of sort of managing over the course of a long year a little bit of thought. But yeah, you know, look, if he feels good, and, you know, to the extent that we need somebody to start a game every day, I don't mind necessarily riding him, you know, while things are going well, and you know, hopefully at some point the cavalry comes back, we get a DeGrom back later in the season or what have you, and deal with it then. But, you know, like I said before, it's so far so good with McGill, and if they want to give him a day off because they think it's going to help him over the course of the season, I'm all for that too.
Mike, your thoughts on McGill and the need to maybe manage his innings?
Rich, I don't know. This is the part of baseball that mystifies me now. You know, in the 19th century, it was baseball, two words. We grew up on the game baseball, one word, in the 20th century. And now in the 21st century, this is modern ball. And these pitchers just aren't built the way they used to. They're not, you know, trained the way they used to. And they're not put through instruction and everything else in the minor leagues the way they used to. You know, these guys aren't Juan Marichal, Steve Carlton, or even Tom Seaver for that matter. And you could fast forward it if you want. Smoltz, Glavin, Maddox. We could throw out a myriad of 1-2 punches and triads out there. But everything changed in this millennium, Rich. I don't know how to answer that question. I don't know how well or badly these guys have built up, how much stamina, dexterity they have. I just don't know. With pitch counts and all these restrictions, I don't know. So, you know, I hope the nerds have this figured out. We rail against them for almost everything else. Let's hope they have a solution for managing his innings, his time, and his exertion. because we just don't know anymore. I mean, the absurdity of injuries in today's game is off the charts. You blow on these guys and they get hurt. So I'm completely confounded, Rich, with this question. I don't know how to answer it. I don't know how to proceed forward and manage his innings. I'm just crossing my fingers and hoping for the best.
Yeah, you know, when you think about it, right, we saw two examples of this last year. So it was right in our faces, right? Because I know we can all point to Taiwan Walker, who was lights out in the first half, made the All-Star team. And then here's a guy who he got hurt in, I believe it was 2018, pitched one game, missed the rest of the season, came back at the very end of 2019, pitched, I think he pitched one game in 2019 at the very end of the season, so two games total in 2 years. Then, of course, 2020 was a shortened season, so everybody's workload was way down. And you saw it. You know, you saw him literally, I know he says differently, but we all saw he wasn't throwing as hard. He was not the same guy after about mid-July or late July. That game against the Pirates in late July is the one that stands out as really the beginning of the end for Taiwan Walker. And if you looked at the progression of innings, it made sense. And now the same thing happened with McGill. You know, here's the shorter seasons in the minor leagues. He just hadn't thrown the innings. And when he got to that magical number, which was, you know, 10 or 15% more than his previous high, he just absolutely fell apart. And that's no knock on him. It's just his body hadn't gone through that. So I do think it's something the Mets have to think about. As you guys both said, we don't know how to do it. We're not pitching coaches. But it is something to think about, that when you're getting these kinds of innings out of a guy like McGill and even Walker, these are guys who are coming back innings-wise. And it's just something to think about as we get into the summer and hopefully into the fall of this baseball season. So getting back to the Mets news, they take 2 out of 3 from the Phillies, which is great, of course. You know, have to beat the divisional rival, just like they did in Philadelphia earlier in the month. Took 2 out of 3. And then let's go to the news of Monday. On Monday, the Mets had to make, and all teams had to cut their rosters down to 26 players from 28. And the injury to Sean Reed Foley, you know, put him on the 60-day. So that was one move that was kind of made for them. They did send down Lopez, and then they had to make a decision. A position player had to go, and we heard the names. We heard Jankowski. We heard Dom Smith going down. We heard Guillorme going down because those guys had options. And then we heard maybe get rid of Cano, and everybody said, well, you know, they won't do that. They own $44 million over the next 2 seasons. They won't do that. Well, lo and behold, they did. So, Mike, I'm going to start with you on this one. Two questions, and I'll, John, same to you, of course. Were you surprised that it was Cano? And secondly, do you agree with it?
Not surprised, and I agree with it. That's a front office. That's an owner thing with conviction. Addition by subtraction, Rich. He wasn't performing. Not that he got a whole lot of at-bats and games to prove himself this year, but he's up there in age. He's, what, 38 years old? And, the time has come. The time has come. We said it numerous times during the offseason. You know, continue the purge and build moving forward. Well, he's part of the purge. And we have an owner that acted with conviction. And I wholly see this as addition by subtraction. He would have gotten in the way, plain and simple. We have too many players log jammed at a couple of positions, and he would have just made matters worse. You know, so now that he's gone, he's no longer an issue. He's no longer an issue for Buck Showalter or the general manager. They don't have to haggle with that anymore. Oh, what are we going to do with this underperforming? Or, you know, if he performed well, what are we going to do with the other players? This just totally eliminates a problem. You know, one of those variables from the equation that you just don't need. Kudos to ownership in the front office. I like the conviction, Rich. That's first and foremost to me.
Well, you know, I think, of course, you know, we all said this, that the DFA of Cano as the choice of someone to go off the major league roster position player wise. If we didn't know that it wasn't the old Mets, like sure we have, you know, example after example that it's not the old Mets anymore. One would be Max Scherzer at $43 million a year. That the Mets are now serious. This is a team that wants to win. This is a team that doesn't make decisions based on money exclusively like the Wilpons did. So if we needed yet another example that these aren't, you know, your grandfathers or your fathers or your older brothers' Mets, you got it, right? Because they designated a guy for assignment to whom they owe $44 million. So to be honest, I thought it was going to be J.D. Davis. I thought because of the money, even though it's not the old Mets, it's a lot of money. I thought because of that, his clubhouse presence, everybody talks about his leadership, a left-handed bat off the bench. I really thought it was going to be J.D. Davis. I'm not sure I want J.D. Davis on the roster at this point. I'm not sure he's doing anything to help the team. But anyway, so, John, I'll go to you on this one. Same two questions. Were you surprised it was Cano in any way, and do you agree with it?
No and yes. not to repeat what the both of you have kind of talked about on this, but look, he was a mistake of the previous administration, I think, and I think that made it a little bit more easy for them to consider, you know, a narrative that said, okay, we're going to sort of rid ourselves of the mistakes that my predecessor made, you know. And look, I think there's some truth to something I read that, Steve can sort of read the Steve Cohen can kind of read the will of the fans if he looks closely enough at Twitter and could see that this was one of those slam dunk decisions, that was going to win the support of the fans. I agree that, the idea of fitting J.D. Davis and Dom Smith and Jeff McNeil, all these guys on this team, I would have anticipated that one of those three would have been traded over the offseason, maybe for more pitching depth or, some other solution. But they didn't do that, and that kind of led them to a decision where they had to, led them to a situation where a decision like this would be inevitable. And we'll see about Cano, I also would remark on the fact that, the players said that they all respected them. You got to figure that as a player, you're asked about your teammate who is still your teammate. You better say to the reporter, he's a very well-respected guy around here in the event that they keep him, right? So I didn't put all that much stock in Lindor's remark that he is a great teammate and a future coach and a leader and all that stuff that might be gleaned from that, despite that being what they said. That's one of the situations where you could sort of expect teammates to kind of give that kind of particular spin on it.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And at the end of the day, it does come down to production, and this is about winning a World Series that we all know this team hasn't done in 37 years. So you have to make decisions that are pointed in that direction, not about necessarily about people like him and all of that. If he's hitting 195, which he was at the time of his DFA, he looked lethargic. He didn't look like the Robinson Cano that – and the sad part is in spring training, Keith kept saying that his bat looked quick. That the first thing you look for in an older player is he'll get the hands through, right? And Keith kept saying that, but he did not look quick. He just didn't. And let me ask you guys this question, to no one in particular, just jump out. Do you think Cano lands somewhere? Let's think about this guy. He's 39. Of course, he can go through for the major league minimum. The Mets have to pay him. And he clearly is declining. Do you think there's a – and with the PD stuff, do you think there's a team that might say, you know what, we'll throw him on the bench as our 26th guy, veteran left-handed bat, or do you think maybe he might just kind of float out there?
I mean, if you're the Cincinnati Reds and you don't pick him up, it sort of reinforces – you know, the secret that everybody knows is that you're not even trying, right? That's a team that not only has their second baseman on the disabled list in Jonathan India, but could use all the help they can get. I think they're 3-20 or 3-21 by now, going nowhere. And in, here's a, you know, borderline Hall of Fame talent, the Hall of Fame talent for sure, probably not a future Hall of Famer at the same time, you know, available to you. You know, that's the kind of thing. So I think there's going to be some teams that aren't taking that aren't really trying, that should get him but won't. And, you know, I thought maybe a team like, you know, I don't know the particulars of the roster situation, but a team that's really trying to contend, like maybe the Los Angeles Angels, or maybe even the Yankees might consider bringing him on for that, you know, for that dangerous veteran bat kind of thing. But, you know, it depends on how he looks. Look, Michael Conforto is available too, and he's not been picked up. So I might pick up Conforto sooner than that, injury and all.
Mike, any thoughts on Cano?
He could very well land somewhere. Somebody might find him useful. Coming off the bench, DH in the everyone's DH now. Wow, have it. But yeah, it's very, very possible he lands somewhere. Will they sign him beyond this year? I don't think so. I think a general manager would be foolish to retain him beyond this year.
For some reason, I see him back with the Yankees. I'll tell you why. I think the Yankees love to stick it to the Mets, and I think if they got 3 home runs out of Cano the rest of the season, they could snicker and say the Mets are paying him to do that for us. I think they're that petty.
Rich? No better time than now, as both teams are in first place, right?
Right. They don't really need him. I mean, they could pick him up just to stick it to the Mets and say anytime he gets a hit, the Mets paid him to do that. That's the kind of pettiness that they have. And anyway, I could see that. But we'll see. So you are listening to the Metsian podcast tonight. It's Mike LeComte and myself, Rich Farago, and we are thrilled to have John Springer from Mets by the Numbers. And you might have heard in the opening that John's written a book that was published in 2008 and 2016 about Mets and about the Mets and their jersey numbers and all of that. So, John, I'd like you to talk us a little bit about where – granted, there's the book out there. Where else can people find your work, you know, perhaps in social media? But I guess the first question I'd like to throw to you is, it's such a cool thing that you did with the numbers. What inspires somebody to do that?
Yeah, you know, you got to kind of go back in time. And when I was a kid, and I'm sure a lot of fans did this when they were little, they connected uniform numbers, you know, as a way to remember things. So like my locker combination or your PIN for your banking account or whatever, you say, you know, what is this? No, it's Gooden Strawberry. Okay, it's 1618, right? Those kinds of things. And so going back, I think it was, you know, 1998, the internet was new to me. I knew that, like, sort of exciting things were being published there, and I was trying to figure out a way that I could participate in that because I wanted to express myself, and I was very much into the Mets at that time. And so I kind of, like, leaned back on this old habit I had of thinking, anyway, that I knew everybody, you name me a Met, I could name his uniform number, you know, that kind of parlor game you can play just watching a game or whatever. And, you know, what you need to understand is at that time, this data wasn't on Baseball Reference. It wasn't published in any books. You know, there was some of this information could be found out there in like pieces of stuff. So it was really a research project, collecting as many old scorecards as I could find. You know, just assessing, you know, an all-time roster was a little bit difficult back then. And, you know, once I did that, my dad and my older brother had millions of old scorecards and scorebooks. My dad kept everything he ever had. So that was a big, you know, way to get started. And then so once I figured that I was close, and I really wasn't close, I was missing like some 150 numbers when the site went live in 1999. But what I did was I you know, wrote a kind of a history that proceeded by number rather than by year. So I would talk about, and this was the same format as the book. In chapter one, I talk about Mookie Wilson, and in chapter two, I talk about Bobby Valentine, and you go to chapter 99, and you're talking about Turk Wendell. So I found a lot of fans once that was up there who also had this secret passion, and many of them, I have to say, you know, knew this information way better than I did. And so I've relied on their help. They're still, it's a small site. I don't sell anything, you know, I'm not making any money from it or any of that stuff. But just as a way to kind of chart the history of the Mets. And like I said, it's been going on now for 23rd year, I think I've been doing it. So it's been fun.
That's fantastic. And on social media, where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm at Springer66. And I mostly post my Wordle scores and comment occasionally on my friend's Mets posts these days. Like I said, I'm not in the process necessarily of selling anything. When the book was new, I was pretty active out there. And I have to say, I don't know if you may have had him as a guest on your another author named Matthew Silverman, who kind of co-authored the book with me originally. It was Matt who found the site and said, this should be a book, which I would never have believed. He helped me out with that. So the two of us, you know, did a fair amount of heavy promotion. But nowadays, like I said, I follow a bunch of Mets accounts, some friends of mine, some Islanders accounts, and just kind of follow sports that way by looking at it and not all that much participating.
Fair enough. Mike, did you have any questions for John?
I have a quick question about the internet itself and, you know, surviving it. You know, the late 90s, the internet was still a little bit of the Wild West. So, you know, do you have any particular, anecdote of something that might have went ruinously wrong at one point?
You know, not really. I mean, I should say this, like, I still don't know, you know, I barely can understand a simple line of code in HTML. So when I built the site, I don't know if you remember this, there was a browser called Netscape Navigator, and that kind of gave you a WYSIWYG tool to do that, you know, and I didn't know how to like resize photographs or any of that stuff. So one of the reasons that the original site, it's changed quite a bit now. Now it looks like a blog. Blogs didn't exist when it started, right? But one of the reasons that it sort of evolved the way it did was that I wasn't really trying to write, whatever, how many words, 50,000 words that on Mets history. What I was really trying to do was write enough text so that I could wrap around the photos that were alongside them and it wouldn't look weird, you know? So that's, you know, that kind of stuff, is fun. I've been through a couple of, redesigns of the site. For a while I was sort of trying to manage the actual database of the uniform numbers by myself. And that became a little bit unwieldy again, due to my lack of, technical skill. And so I'm sure you're familiar with the Ultimate Mets database. I know that guy, he started that site, by the way, right around the same week that mine did in February of 99. I knew Rich from that site, and he graciously agreed to help me organize that. And the actual database for the blog, for the project, actually resides on the Ultimate Mets database now. So you go to my site, you can link over to it in a click. But So those were some of the, you know, some of the challenges of it. Like I said, today it's one of these things I update it 3 or 4 times a month. Usually when there's player news, people are always sending email or alerting the site when, you know, Adonis Medina comes up, I get 5, 10 emails. He's wearing number 44, you know, people reminding me on Twitter, you know, that kind of thing. And, I have fun with it. You know, I make lists of guys who wore 44 or try to figure out what in common, you know, these guys have. It's not to get too like technical about it, but one of the ways that it really helped was a different kind of spin on history, right? It kind of a side door to the team history. And the reason I say that is that if you kind of like reverse engineer the progression of ball players to wear a uniform number, what you really find is a history of roster decisions and trades and, you know, front office philosophies that drove that, you know, and helped to a better understanding of sort of what the team was doing at the time. And doing the project really helped me to understand that. You know, highlighting eras where there was a lot of activity, like 1967, which until recently was the year that the Mets had more ball players than any other year that they had. And what you saw, if you look closely at that season, it was, you know, oh, it's weird. We have four guys who wore the same number that year. But really what it was Bing Devine making the trades that assembled the 1969 team, you know, right in front of you. It's just, oh, it's really this weird thing about uniform numbers, you know? So that's kind of cool. That's been a fun part of it.
And thanks for mentioning Bing Devine. I love throwing him into the mix just to rub it in, you know?
Yeah.
Whitey Herzog at that point was in the front office, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Herzog and Devine, yeah. I've done quite a bit of research on Devine because, again, stemming from this numbers project, I kind of realized who Devine was. I really was only there for a short period of time. You know, he went back to the Cardinals after coming from the Cardinals. He and really losing him and then really not having a succession plan for Johnny Murphy, who succeeded him, was really the thing that doomed the Mets from truly capitalizing on the fact that they had assembled a championship level team in 69. You know, they misband, they made a bad managerial choice. They didn't really make a very good front office choice. Following those years, let Whitey Herzog go, who is a really great baseball mind. And you could kind of see a drip into the sort of irrelevant 1970s, you know, that the Mets are having.
Yeah. I love rubbing salt into that one.
Well, thank you, John, for the background.
Yeah.
That and we'll talk, you know, at the end, I do want to carve out a couple of minutes to talk about anything unique number wise that maybe really stood out to you as you did the research for the book. But getting back to the week that was for the New York Mets. So, you know, we talked about the combined no-hitter, talked about the Philly series, talked about the DFA of Robinson Cano. And now that brings us to the Braves series where the Mets split it. And it was the first series of the season that the Mets did not win. They didn't lose it either, but they split 4 games, bookending with Braves wins and a Mets doubleheader sweep in the middle. So I guess it's time to ask the question, and Mike, I'll start with you. I was a little disappointed today that they didn't win the series, and I know it's early, and splitting is not awful and all of that. And to me, it has nothing to do with winning consecutive series, you know, or any kind of record. That doesn't really matter to me anyway. To me, it's like, you know, the Braves were the world champions. They were 7 games out going into today. I just want to kick them to the curb and kick them 5 more times. Just make sure that they know who's boss. And I thought today would have been an opportunity to do that. Mets didn't do it. So they played the Braves a lot more the rest of the season, have many more opportunities, but I don't know. while I understand it's about getting greedy and all those kinds of things and understand they're playing good ball and it's one game, it's because it's that team. Yes, they're the world champions. That does not help. But I just want to, you know, figuratively, folks, not literally, you know, run them over six times with a garbage truck and make sure they're out of the way for the rest of the season. And that didn't happen today. Not that winning today would have done that. But anyway, so Mike, what are your thoughts on the series with the Braves and splitting it?
Rich, I'm with you. However, I'm going to be just a little bit more lenient. Okay, we lost the opener 5-2. But Tuesday we took two games, a doubleheader. We beat them twice in one day. That made me happy. And being that we were playing our fourth game in 3 days, I was, you know, already being a little lenient as to what was going to transpire today. And we saw the implosion before our very eyes. So I going into today's game, I thought we might have some bullpen issues. We got greater bullpen issues. But today specifically, you know, coming off a doubleheader and another game before that, I thought today was going to be a coin flip. The fact that we split four games with the defending world champions and, you know, we're up to this good start. We have yet to lose a series. And, you know, this didn't change that. I'm okay. As you say, Rich, we've got a lot of more games ahead against this team in the division. And so far, so good. So far, so good.
Good grounding perspective. We'll go to you on this one, John. I have this thing about the Braves. I just can't stand that organization. And that's part of it, them being world champs, another part. Not putting them away last year in late July when they had the chance is another part. I worry that they're going to Freddy Krueger us and, you know, come back from the dead again. So where are you on splitting this week?
Yeah, I mean, well, look, I didn't see much of today's game, so I'm not going to have a great perspective on that. I was quite disappointed in their performance on Monday, and, you know, that was just kind of a dead game. And so from my perspective, let's be positive that they came back the following day and won not once but twice. It also happened to be my first visit out to Citi Field this year, and a good time and almost a record time for a doubleheader. You know, that was, again, two pretty business-like wins after a pretty disappointing opening game I was very satisfied with. And, you know, you can't win them all. It sounds like today they had, well, they didn't get effective relief from Ottavino, who looks like, you know, he might be a little bit like you were describing Diaz earlier. Some days he's got it and some days he doesn't. If you compare, one outing to the next with him, but I'm okay with it. I totally get what you're saying about the opportunity to kind of step on a team's neck and put them away. You know, that was really the story of the first half of last year. You know, it was all about what a struggle it was just to get to where we were when we woke up this morning, which was 10 games over 500. And then, of course, they couldn't stay there. I believe 11 games over last season was their high watermark. And you can't expect, team that gotten off to a worse start than you that not catch up to you eventually, or at least not have the possibility to do so when you can't get better than 10 games over 500. So, you know, win some, lose some, let's move on.
Yeah, that's good perspective. And having talked about that, I think it's a good segue to look forward. So the Mets have four with the Phillies, which is almost unbelievable. You know, you played them in early April, played them three at Citi Field, and then 4 days later you play them four in Philadelphia. And then believe it or not, right before Memorial Day, they play them three more times at Citi Field. So they will have 13 of their 19 games with the Phils in the books before June 1st, which is a kind of a scheduling anomaly. But looking ahead until our next podcast, we have the Phillies coming up. Mets play four in Philadelphia and then three in Washington. So talk about that series. The good news is the Mets miss Zach Wheeler for the second time. I'm watching the game as we speak, the Phillies game, and Zach pitched, I think it was 8 innings of shutout ball. Phillies are now behind in the 10th inning. But Zach was amazing. So it's good to miss him. They have NOLA tomorrow night. So let's go there. So coming up, we have, you know, seven games in division, four with the Phillies, three with the Nationals. Looking out, Mike, you know, what would be good to you? Like, what do you think's realistic, and what would you like to see the Mets do in those seven games? And any particular observations you may have about the upcoming week?
I would just like to see them continue what they're doing, and that's win series. Can't win every game. So if we take three out of four from the Phillies and two out of three from Washington, I'll be ecstatic. If we split with Philadelphia, I'll settle. But this is not a season for that. We're not settling. Again, new ownership, new expectations. So I'm looking to compete, and I'm looking specifically at Carrasco. I want to see him continue his good pitching. I want to see consistency out of him. So I'm going to have my eye on him. And, you know, everyone else for that matter, and, you know, we got to see how Buck is going to negotiate this bullpen moving forward. But I'm looking forward to a little trip to Philadelphia and Washington, local. That's fun. Division rivals, that's baseball. I like that. And then we come back home.
So, John, as I go to you, I'll say tomorrow night, Taiwan Walker takes the mound. Fine. You know, no problem there against Aaron Nola. That should be, at least on paper, a good matchup. But isn't it nice to say that on Friday night, Max Scherzer takes the mound for the New York Mets? I'm still kind of like in disbelief that I say those words. So upcoming week for the Mets, John, and if you want to make a comment on Scherzer, if you want to talk about his antics of getting thrown out of the game last night to protect Dom, so I thought that was great. But your thoughts on that?
Hey, I love Scherzer's competitiveness. He's one of these guys, you know, I wouldn't necessarily have picked that up, only seeing him as an opponent. So I like that he's on our side. You know, and I'm with you guys on the idea that, you know, it's important to win series. Look, if we won them both, that's 5 out of 7. What's realistic? 4 out of 7, you know, take them however you can. I think the Phillies are are going to be a very difficult team over the course of a long year because they really can hit and their stadium is good for hitting. You know, that said, I think the games that we've won, they've been exposed for the kind of cutting corners to get there defensively. And I think, you know, those are the kinds of little margin things that are going to make up the difference in the long run. And, you know, if you were to kind of look at it dispassionately and predict, the Mets have a stronger defense, a comparable offense, and just as good, if not better, pitching in bullpen, you know, that's why you like the Mets.
And then going to Washington, you know, something the Mets have to do, let's face it, the Nationals are proving what we thought would be the case. And last I looked, they were 8-16, might be a game or two off of that. But they have to stick it to the Nationals. They do. Then they come home and they play the Nationals. They play the Mariners next weekend, not this weekend, next weekend, and then the Nationals again. So, you know, the Mariners also are struggling. And and so you have an opportunity over this next set of games, you know, to put some wins in the win column. And that's a good team. So look what the Yankees are doing. You know, the Yankees, much I hate to talk about them on a Mets podcast, but they played the Indians, they played the Guardians, and the Royals, and they swept, and the Orioles, and they swept them all. They swept every one of those games. And that's what you have to do. And that's been their business model over the years, is they beat the living tar out of the teams that they're supposed to beat. Well, Mets, you know what? This is your chance, right? I mean, this is your chance to absolutely go in there and think about it. The Phillies are under 500, but we'll say they're going to be a good team. I do agree. If you split that, I'd actually be okay with that in Philadelphia, but you've got to beat up on the Nationals. Then the Mariners are 500. You've got to beat up on them, and you've got to whoop up on the Nationals in the next six games they have coming up against them. And like you say, pad that win column wherever you could get them, right?
Yeah.
And you know what, Rich? I agree 1,000,000% with that, specifically the Nationals. Everyone remembers the bench clearer against St. Louis. That put the original bench clearer that we had against the Nationals in the rearview mirror. That's two for the season. We're going back to Washington. It's not like they're coming here. We're going back there. So I'm with you. I really want to stick it to Washington, especially after, what was that, the second game of the season we had the bench player, right?
Yes. It was the Apple TV game, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm with you on that one. I really want to go to Washington and stick it to them.
And then, you know, just the Mets haven't played the Marlins yet, and I don't believe they do until June. The Marlins are playing good ball. I believe they won today, which would make their record 13-11. They're the only other team in the division that's over 500. So, you know, this division, you know, the Braves are not going to end the season under 500. I really don't believe that. They're three under now. The Phillies, if they lose this game, they're down 2-0 in the bottom of the 10th. They will be three under 500, just like the Braves. And the Marlins are two over. So this will all shake itself out. And I said earlier in the podcast, I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, you know, that you can't look at the standings this early, and it is kind of silly to do that. But that's the way it looks right now. And so this upcoming week in Mets baseball, it's in division before their first interleague games next weekend. So it's in division, and you've got to win these games, you know, because you know what? I don't think the Braves are going to feel sorry for the Nationals when they play them. I don't think the Phillies are going to feel sorry for the Nationals when they play them. They're going to whoop up on them, and the Mets have to whoop up on them. So hopefully they can do that. So that's the
week. Hey, that's an idea. Before you move on, I just want to inform you, in case you didn't know, Diamondbacks scored 2 runs in the 9th and beat the Marlins today, 8-7. So the Marlins are just 12-12.
Nice. Oh, you know what? The Marlins had taken the lead in the 8th inning of that game. I did not realize that. Thank you, John.
Yeah. Yeah. You're welcome.
That worked out. every now and then you catch a break, right? Just like these Texas Rangers, if they can get 2 more outs, they're going to sweep the Phillies 3 games in Philadelphia. How about that? All right, so we have talked about the week that was for the Mets. We've talked about the week that is coming up for the Mets. And I think there's one more thing I want to touch on before talking to John a little bit about Mets by the numbers, and that would be the health of Trevor May. We saw him on Monday night say that he wasn't healthy. He said that every pitch he throws, it doesn't feel right, and he knows what it's like to be a bullpen guy, and your arm never feels great, but he knew something was wrong. And so here's where I'm going with this question. I'll start with you, John. As much as we've turned the page on the Wilpons and the Wilpon way of doing things, that didn't feel good. It's like, you know, if he's saying he's not well, they did not put him on the IL when he reported discomfort in the Phillies series. So he had this discomfort. They didn't put him on the IL. They kept him out of a few games. Then he's back, and he's saying that don't feel right. It's something's not right. I know it's not right. But yet they kept putting him out there. I'm not blaming him for the loss on Monday night, not by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not so much talking about that. I'm talking about that general way of putting guys out there who you know are not healthy. It was a slight blip on the radar that just gave me PTSD back to the Wilpon era. Any thoughts on that, John?
You know, not really beyond the fact that, you know, I guess I wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to May having been or said anything about not feeling well. But as a fan and as somebody who saw him last year in this, you know, something wasn't right. and if I could tell, you know, by watching, I'm sure that the club knew too. And, you know, maybe I guess you'd have to presume that they thought that this was something that, you know, he would work out and, you know, work out on the mound. And, but guess what? I mean, these guys get paid a lot of money. They're expected to be, you know, the best in the world at what they do. And, so, you know, I kind of understand both ways of it. Obviously you don't want to hurt somebody or put them in a bad spot, but you know, hey, it's a dangerous game. People get hurt. And I'm just, you know, I'm almost relieved to find out that he was hurt rather than, you know, that he just lost it or, you know, he couldn't be relied on anymore, because you figure if and when he gets healthy, he could be, you know, what he was last year.
Yeah. And Mike, I'll go to you on this one where I saw today, like just like 2 hours before the show, that he's not going to throw for 4 weeks and be reevaluated. But they're anticipating that in the most likely scenario, he won't be available to the Mets for 8 to 12 weeks, which means that we won't see him until the All-Star break or after the All-Star break. So what do you think of all this? What do you think of the fact that it at least seems as though the Mets knew he wasn't right and he knew he wasn't right, but yet he kind of forced it a little bit? What do you think of all this?
Well, before we learned how long he was going to be out, you know, At first I was like, that was a little scary to hear. It leaves a lot open to speculation in so far as how the Mets go about their business again. And at the same time, I was thinking, you know, maybe that was exasperation on his part. Not all players are, you know, effective public speakers. But then we learned how long he's going to be out and why. So, you know, he told no lie. And this is up to Billy Epler now. It was up to Billy Epler to manage this going along. And, you know, here we are now. What he knew, didn't know, how they went about it, how they treated it, how they diagnosed it, I don't know. And I don't think we'll ever know. But to hear Trevor May put it in those words on TV like that, that was a little scary. You know, we thought that moving forward, this team was going to keep things somewhat more in-house. But, you know, that's being brutally honest. So I don't know. I put this on Billy Epler. He's got to address not only health issues and potential health risks, but he's got to shore up his bullpen, and he's got to do it quick.
He does, because Ottavino pitched for the third time in 3 days today, and that was a big deal, and that was the first question they asked Buck in the post game, and he said Adam felt good, and, you know, I have no problem going in for a third day. I don't think it was that. He wasn't tired, just didn't get the job done today. He didn't say it in those exact words. That's what he implied. And then talking to Ottavino, he said the same thing. He said, nope, they asked me if I was ready. I told them I was ready. I don't feel tired at all. I just didn't make good pitches. So, but you have to wonder, it's pretty obvious, if Trevor May's available, that's a situation where you probably don't have to use Ottavino 3 days in a row. So what it does is it shows you that there's a gap there. Yes, they called up Medina. Medina, of course, isn't as accomplished as Trevor May. I'm not sure they have the same level of confidence in him. It's too early to start making trades. You know, no team is waving the white flag now, although the red should be. No team is waving the white flag right now, selling off parts. But with May going to be out for a while, for 3 months, and the Rangers just completed the sweep of the Phillies, it's something that we have to keep our eyes on, you know. May was a big piece of that bullpen. He was the right-hander in the seventh inning. He was sometimes the eighth inning guy. And you remember, he closed that game against the Giants, second game of the doubleheader a couple weeks ago when Diaz had pitched in the first game. So they lost a pretty good piece there. And again, I'm not sure what they do at this point. They don't have a lot of depth. We know that in the minor league system. And again, you don't see a lot of trades this early. So we'll just have to see how they manage this. It is the first little you know, glitch that they've had, and let's see how they manage it, because while it's not a huge piece, May's a fairly important piece that has gone down and will be down for a while. So with that having been said, you're listening to the Metsian podcast with Michael Collett, myself, Rich Sparago, and also our very special guest, John Springer of Mets by the Numbers. And we have one more piece of business to do. Let's have a little fun with it, John. And you know, you talked about your book and you talked about your inspiration for it and how you got there. But you had to do a lot of research, and you talked about that a little bit, and to be able to write the book. So as you're going through the research and as you're learning more and more about the Mets by the Numbers, can you share an anecdote or two about something you're like, wow, you know, that's really weird that this guy wore that number, or this guy was a Met three times and wore these different numbers and combinations, or anything that might jump out?
Yeah, two things that you know, are kind of white whales for the site. You know, one was Jesse Orosco's major league debut in 1979. I was told by Pivo, this is back, you know, when I, you know, didn't have the documentation to prove it. The Mets opened the 1979 season in Chicago. Jesse Orozco made his major league debut, pitching two innings of relief, I believe, in that game. I think he finished close the game out. The Mets won. And I was told Jesse Orozco wore number 61 in that game. And I said, Jesse Orozco is number 47. That's the only number he's ever worn, you know. And going back on it, I kind of sent out the bat signal, you know, message on the website. Anybody can prove that Jesse Orozco wore number 61, show me. And believe it or not, I got a scorecard from a guy in Chicago who was actually at the game. And you can see he, sent me a screenshot of the actual scorecard where he – crossed out 47 and wrote 61 in pencil of the game he kept score that showed it. And I said, wow, this is remarkable. You know, this guy who told me that this 61 but couldn't prove it, it was actually right. And then sometime later, I found a guy who actually had the videotape from that game. And somewhere out there, it might be on YouTube now, is the 1979 opener. And not only is it unusual that Orozco is wearing number 61, but at that time it was the highest number I believe any Met had ever worn. But 1979 was also the first year that the Mets put nameplates, player last names over the numbers, and Orozco's 61 jersey didn't have one. And, again, how it fit all clicks into the big picture, that related to the story of the 1979 season where they were going under financially and the Payson family heirs were about to sell. And during that spring training, if you recall, the Mets had some veteran pitchers. Nelson Briles was one, and somebody else, Andy Hassler, I want to say. But either way, they released these guys during spring training to save money. And they hadn't given Orozco a major league jersey by the time that decision was made, completely financial. And so that was one story. You know, the other piece that kind of got the site a lot of attention in the early days was you recall a reserve infielder named Jeff McNeil, who had two different stints with the Mets. He became the first and is still the only guy who has worn five different uniform numbers with the Mets. And that relates to the fact that he'd been up and down with the team a number of times. He had a disconnected service time. He was wearing number seven, and when Torborg came in as the manager, or was it Torborg got fired? I can't recall the details offhand. One of his coaches, Bobby Wine, wanted number seven, and so he had to take a different number. McNeil had number 18 going into the next season, and the Mets had acquired Brett Saberhagen, and Saberhagen wanted number 18, so he had to move to something else. And I loved it because it was a great story about one of these guys who's, you know, these little scribinis at the end of the roster who'll do anything to make the team. And so I devoted a whole chapter in my book to the Jeff McNeil story.
I think, is it Jeff McKnight you're referring to?
Jeff McKnight, of course. Jeez. Yes, Jeff McKnight. Jeff McNeil, I've heard of him before. He's not a Scribini. Jeff McKnight,
well,
of course.
I bring that up because his name came into my head, and I looked him up. Oh, God, it had to be a month ago, 2 months ago, for whatever the reason. And I believe he passed away a couple of years ago.
Yep. Yeah, he did.
And, okay, yeah. So, all right, that's a Jeff McKnight story. And I believe Jeff McKnight was the guy that Torborg really liked. He also liked that remember the relief pitcher with the glasses, Paul Gibson?
Yes.
I remember when Torborg would be on with Mike and the Mad Dog, he had certain guys that he just loved. And McKnight was one, and I can get it. You know, McKnight kind of was like McNeil, you know, although McNeil I think is more talented. But,
yeah.
A guy I could – over, right? That kind of a guy. So anything else? Like anything else pop up? That's a great story about McKnight.
That's a good story about McKnight. You know, the other one was the Kelvin Torvey story. Do you remember Kelvin Torvey?
Sure. Yeah.
He was a reserve infielder, first baseman. When he came up in 1990 for the first time, the Mets issued him uniform number 24. And at that time, you know, 24 had been in sort of unofficial mothballs since the retirement of Willie Mays, in reference or in honor, really, of Joan Payson, who was Willie Mays' biggest fan and, you know, of course, the original owner of the Mets. And, you know, I've always argued that the Mets should have retired number 24 for Joan Payson, not for Willie Mays. That would have been the right thing to do, you know. But, you know, whether or not they issued 24 to Kelvin Torvey accidentally, as the team would say, or sort of as a way to test this, whether the fans would forgive them if they did. And I think what they found was that the fans did not. And before long, Torvey was reissued number 39. And one of the fun things about that was I actually got to I tracked down Kelvin and discussed this whole story with him. And, you know, his perspective was great. He had a great attitude about it. You know, he was one of these guys who said, I would take, you know, any number they gave me. I didn't care about that. And the last thing that he wanted to do was, you know, be involved in any controversy, you know, just kind of making his major league debut and all that. But he was really great. He told me some great stories. And you'll remember this. He was, I think it was his first game. Now, don't quote me on that. It was being his first game. But Torvey was involved in a Mets-Phillies game in 1990 that involved an ugly brawl with Gooden and Pat Combs. And I don't know if you guys remember that game, but there's a great I came across a video from that game and a number of great photos that shows this big scrum on the field and then this, like, for a Mets uniform number, you know, a person who pays attention to that kind of thing, this idea that there's like this big white dude in number 24 in the middle of it wearing a Mets jersey. And I'm like, what, you know, what is this guy doing there? That's the Kelvin Torvey experiment, caught on film in a memorable game, that we might not have remembered.
How about that? And one more for me before I turn it to Mike. I know Mike probably has some, Mets numbers from the past that he might want to ask about, but I want to ask about number 17. It's just bizarre. You know, Keith, I'm not talking about anybody who worked before Keith, but Keith comes on the team. You know, he clearly was the first imported piece that was an enormous piece of the puzzle toward the 86 championship. Just really an outstanding Met all around. And they go and give his number to other guys. I mean, you know, like, what are they thinking? Keith's number had to be retired. To me, that was obvious. And they gave it to Jose Lima, you know, God rest his soul. He passed away a few years ago, a long time ago, actually. And I think a couple of other guys have worn 17 since.
Oh, and, dozens. And like, dozens, yeah.
What the hell? I mean, any thoughts on that? Like, who wore 17 that I'm not thinking about? I think of Lima, but who else?
I want to say Satoru Komiyama, but I'm not entirely sure of that off the top of my head. Remember him? He was one of the first relief pitchers they got in from Japan. Mike Bordick in 2000, I believe, had 17, I think. I mean, you know, I'm a sort of a small hall guy when it comes to uniform numbers. What I wish the Mets would do, and I would wish the team would do, would be not to necessarily retire a guy's number, but maybe reissue it judiciously. So if there was a, you know, a good looking young first baseman come up, maybe you give him number 17 as a means to sort of wish him well and you know, that kind of thing, the way they do in soccer normally. You know, a tradition is where they issue number 10 to the guy they think can be the best goal scorer. You know, I would have argued 10 years ago that they probably shouldn't retire 17 because, you know, Keith's career with the Mets was obviously resplendent for 4 years, and then, you know, kind of the end of his career and the majority of his, you know, the rest was, you know, with St. Louis where he won an MVP and those kinds of things. But that, you know, that his stature due to his result of his broadcasting skill and his quirkiness and, you know, all that has sort of done a better job at making his case in the subsequent years. For example, I'm also against them retiring number 8 for Gary Carter. And I think that it's a slippery slope because how can you recognize the 86 Mets by retiring Gary Carter's number if you're not going to retire Dwight Gooden's 16 and Strawberry's 18. And, you know, it just gets into an ugly thing. So I think if they really thought about it, you know, the right thing they could do, they could retire number 86 for the whole lot of them and just say, this is a number we're never going to issue because there were so many great players and so many important figures on that team that came up. But on the other hand, I do get the fact that they were careless when it comes to some reissues. You know, they issued number 7 about 5 minutes after Ed Cranepool disappeared, at the time where he held every record, you know, the Mets ever had for offensive players. Hubie Brooks was in that uniform within, you know, the very first week of the 1980 season. So interesting stuff. I'm happy for Keith and seeing that number go away.
And as I turn it to Mike, I'll just say you mentioned number 10. And of course, my guy, and everybody who ever listened to this podcast knows my guy, wore number 4 and number 10, and we know who that is, right? His two stints.
Yep.
Le Grand Orange, my absolute guy. I love Seaver's my number 1, but Rusty's always – because Seaver, nobody could touch him. Of everybody else, Rusty's number 1. And so thank you for mentioning number 10.
You know why Rusty wore number 4 instead of number 10?
I do not.
It was because Duffy Dyer had number 10 when he arrived, and Rusty was too much of a gentleman to ask.
He had been
a 10 with.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. Right. I it's very simple. It's a simple explanation. Duffy, I was talking about Duffy Dyer on Sunday on the 5-borough bike ride. I was riding next to somebody who's a big Mets fan, and we were talking about it and how much I abnormally liked Duffy Dyer. You know, I just really liked him for whatever the reason. And right, he was number 10, so it's the obvious answer. He had number 10. Yeah. Rusty was so much of a – thank you for sharing that.
Duffy was an excellent hitter for a reserve catcher, especially back then.
Yeah. I always liked him. Mike, let me turn it to you. You and just so you know, John, one of the things we used to do on the podcast is we would liken the number of the podcast. It was episode, you know, number 41. We would say, let's talk about any Met who's ever worn 41 or 40 or whatever it was. So we've done a lot with Met uniform numbers. So Mike, maybe you have an anecdote or a question for John about numbers.
Well, you already answered the one about Willie Mays. I think they should put that one to rest just for the New York City and National League legacy. And Rich, I'm going to piggyback on you and Rusty Staub in that era. John, what say you about a 2-time National League champion and world champion in 69, a very integral part of this team? And really, I think one of the standout individuals of the 69 and 73 teams, Tug McGraw. Where do you stand on him? He's somebody very near and dear to my heart.
Love the guy as a Met, and I mean his charm and his charisma as a ball player made him a legend with the Mets and the Phillies. And I think there's very few guys that you could say are universally loved by both Mets and Phillies fans. And so, I'm a big Tug fan. especially when I was young. You know, seeing him in the game, like, to me, always told me, you know, the Mets were winning this game. You know, you knew less about, you know, this idea that, you know, a closer was the guy who only pitched the last inning when you were at a lead, whereas, you know, Tug was a true fireman, right? They came in when they needed him, and he always did the job. Loved him.
Same. Anything else, Mike, for John about numbers? I could do this all night, but unfortunately, we're coming to you.
No.
You know, I'll say one more thing related. Yeah. I was going to say related to numbers, you got the, you know, the well, not, I was going to say the two best left-handed closers of all time, but I'm forgetting about Jesse here. But, you know, when Franco had to move because of Piazza coming with number 31, he went to 45. And I don't know offhand if he ever said that's because of Tug McGraw, but I wouldn't doubt that that influenced his decision.
Wow.
See? Makes sense. I mean, you know, Frank grew up in New York. I believe he grew up in Manhattan.
Exactly.
He said that. And, and if, you know, he's a guy who would have been a kid, you know, when Tug was pitching. So, left-handed pitcher, you know, when you're at the St. John's and all that, I could totally see where Tug would be his guy. So, believe me, this is fascinating for me because I've always kind of been into uniform numbers as well. But you have been listening to the Metsian podcast with Mike and Rich tonight, and if you've enjoyed as much as I have the past couple of minutes talking about the numbers, Mets numbers with John Springer, please be sure to look up his work, Mets by the Numbers, and I'm sure you'd find many, many more anecdotes. This is just the very, very tip of the iceberg that we've been able to talk about here, and it certainly was very enjoyable. So, gentlemen, this is the point of the night where we do our last word, where we just, you know, go around and say a word or a small phrase that you're thinking about, Mets related. So, Mike, why don't we start with you, and so John can get the idea. What would be your last word tonight? Nope, I think you're muted, Mike.
You're absolutely right. I was. In the spirit of Sam Maxwell, keep pushing forward. Keep pressing. You know, that's probably what he would say if I had to take a guess, and that's the way I feel. Keep pressing. We're off to a good start. We're in good shape, and you know, let's keep it going.
Works for me. John, once again, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been a pleasure talking baseball with you. I love to talk about the numbers. Once again, John Springer from Mets by the Numbers. He has a book out there. You know, please be sure to check that out. So, John, once again, thank you. And if you'd like to say anything about one more, we call it the shameless plug, and what might be your last word?
I got nothing to plug, but you can visit my website at mbtn.net. Last word, hey, I'm thrilled with this team so far. Jeff McNeil is back.
There you go. My last word's going to be basically the same. You know, keep pushing. It's a long season. We all saw 4 months of good baseball last year, and then we know what happened. So don't take your foot off the gas pedal, gentlemen. Keep pressing forward. And hopefully when we gather again at some point next week to talk Mets baseball, we'll be talking about continued good play. So thank you to my good friend, Mike LeColin. Thank you to John Springer from Mets by the Numbers for joining us tonight. And most of all, thanks to all of you listening, whether you listen live or pick this up wherever you pick up your podcast. So I will do my best Sam Maxwell imitation and say that the way to end this is by saying the only thing Mets fans have all said in unison since 1962, and that would be, let's go Mets. Everybody have a great night. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, John.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you, John.
Have
thank you very kindly.
Bye.
Good night, Metsville.
Thanks, John. All right,
yep.
Bye now.
Bye now.